Hello and welcome to another episode of the Armchair Strategist podcast.
Let's carry on now to 1962, which was a pretty big event in Indian history. So what happened in 1962?
Okay, so a very brief background, because this is more contemporary and I think this is fairly well understood already. So what happened was that China had border disputes with India and with Pakistan. The second aspect is not that well known in India. But in 1959, Ayub Khan actually proposed to India that the two countries should have a common patch against China. I mean, you can see how far things have come from there. Anyway, so China at that time was already regarded as a bit of a troublemaker. That they were trying to advance their borders everywhere, issue with Taiwan, issues over islands in the South China Sea, South Asia, you name it. Now, the thing about the border is that on the Indian side, there was definitely a lack of preparedness. India felt that we should advance our borders, that Arunachal Pradesh belonged to us in toto. But after being caught napping in Aksai Chin, when the Chinese walked in, India became more wary. And there was something called the forward policy.
In Aksai Chin, what happened was, sometime in the 50s, Indians had no presence in Aksai Chin, and the Chinese just sort of advanced and took the whole plateau.
That's right. That's the background.
Yes.
So, India launched a kind of forward policy where they said we will go forward and we will occupy these territories and sort of show our strength, area dominance. They're going to walk into these areas which traditionally the British did not bother to man because there was no point manning them. There was no revenue to be collected there in the northern reaches of Arunachal Pradesh. Trade was minimal because the Tibetans like to just shut themselves off from the entire world. This area received some attention when the Japanese invaded Southeast Asia. So then you needed the Silk Belt Road, you had to start coordinating supplies, coordinating the defense of northeastern India, the battles of Imphal, Kohima, and so on. But now this area became very important from a military perspective. The problem with this forward policy was that the Indian Army was not adequately supplied. They were not adequately provisioned. The second problem, this part has been well known, and this is used to criticize Jawaharlal Nehru and Krishna Menon quite correctly. But there's a second aspect to it, which has been hushed up. The generals of the Indian Army in this area were, quite frankly, incompetent. The generals who were responsible for pushing this, I'm not talking about the overall chief, General Timaiya. He was a man of great competence. But some of the men under him, some of the men who were directly dealing with the Eastern Theater, with the area known as NIFA back then, Northeastern Frontier Agency, today it's Arunachal Pradesh, there was in particular a General Kaul, who was a favorite of Nehru's. He was partly responsible for bungling up on this front. So what happened was the Indian Army moved in without weaponry, without ammunition, for several months. At this point of time, the Cuban Missile Crisis broke out in 1962. The U.S. and the Soviet Union, suddenly the threat of nuclear war, the entire world's attention was focused there. China saw its opportunity. This is a standard Chinese tactic. Trouble breaks out anywhere, that's a great distraction. You move in, you kill the chicken to scare the monkeys. They knew that the rest of the world would be focused elsewhere. The Soviet Union might need Chinese support diplomatically. So they seized this moment. They moved in force in the Northeastern Frontier Agency and attacked Indian troops.
They were coming from a position of strength because they were using a battle-hardened army from Korea where they just come out of fighting. They were armed with good high-altitude equipment, very inured to the cold from fighting in the Korean highlands. And under battle-hardened leadership of generals who had fought the U.S. Army's latest weapons in Korea. And this was up against the Indian Army, who were basically still a World War II army, and who were still armed with World War II vintage weapons, and who simply didn't possess the numbers in those highlands because of the bad logistical situation.
Not just World War II vintage, there was a basic issue with the army that there was no mountain division worth the name. Because the British, so the Indian Army basically is the creation of the British post-1857, right? The thing about the British was almost none of their wars were conducted against mountain opponents, barring occasional skirmishes in Afghanistan. But obviously, the Hindu Kush is not comparable to the Eastern Himalayas. This is proper mountain fighting where infantry is everything, more than tanks, more than anything else.
Infantry and artillery.
And artillery, yes, and artillery. So India had no mounted division worth the name at this point. This is the one kind of theater where Indian troops lacked experience, they lacked equipment. The one thing they did not lack, in a very memorable phrase from Time magazine, the Indians lacked everything except courage. They were very courageous. Even after being denied basic supplies for months, they fought ferociously, but they were massacred because the Chinese lost wave after wave of troops, thoroughly acclimatized to that area. And now there's an important feature here in Galwan Valley as well. The Chinese first moved in, then asked for talks. And while the talks were going on, they used this time to acclimatize their troops. They spent the last 2 months acclimatizing their troops in that area. They did something very similar in the Arunachal Pradesh area 60 years ago. While talks were going on to resolve the situation, their troops got ready to fight. And their side of Tibet is flatter. They can bring trucks, convoys, much more easily than we can on our side.
Like
in Arunachal
Pradesh. They can stage more material, basically, at a high altitude.
Absolutely.
For use later. Whereas we occupy basically a thin 20 kilometer or 30 kilometer ridge of highly mountainous terrain. And we don't have like these flat plateaus
right,
where we can stage large amounts of men and material.
That's of course right. But there's a slight advantage there. Because of the distance, geographical distance, we have to bring our planes from lower altitudes and fly them in there. They
right.
have to stage their planes right there in Tibet at higher altitudes, which means you're burning more fuel, lesser oxygen to burn the fuel, and so on.
But then, of course, we didn't actually have the creativity to utilize air power, whereas we could have easily turned the war with air power.
Well, actually, we didn't use the air force in any significant way. It was transport, as far as I know. And they're very proud of the fact that the air force is proud of the fact that they did not lose a single plane. But I don't think the air force saw any combat over the skies of Tibet. Unfortunately, because I think they were superior to their Chinese equivalent. At this
right,
point,
but they could have used the air force for close air support, right, or bombing the supply lines of the Chinese.
They could have
seriously impeded the advance, and we didn't really go down that route very specifically because Nehru didn't want to escalate the situation.
So right, so here's the thing: Nehru is to blame more than him as Defense Minister Krishnamenon. But I have to say, and I'm sorry to say, that the generals of the Indian Army did not cover themselves in glory during this phase.
I agree. Yeah.
This is a fact that goes overlooked. In particular, there is one general I wish to point out here.
That's General Call.
General Sane.
General Sane.
General
okay.
Call, of course. Right. So General Call, of course, is known. His role in this botch-up has been well documented.
Right.
That he did not provide the necessary leadership. But the head of the Eastern Army Command, the general officer commanding of Eastern Army Command, was General Prateep Sane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a highly decorated officer. His nickname was Bogi. He was called Bogi Sane. This is the man who led the Kashmir war effort in 1948, less than 15 years before this China war. And scholars have often blamed India's inability to rid Pakistan-occupied Kashmir of the Pakistan army. They say it was partly because of General Sane's tactical blunders. He made mistake after mistake. He did not go for the right target at the right time. There is plenty of scholarship to suggest that he was to blame for that particular failure of the army. And after 14 months of trying, when the army could not evict them, finally, the political leadership gave up and said, fine, just call a ceasefire. The army started blaming Nehru for it. So this has been a traditional tactic of the army. When individuals in the army are to blame, you take Nehru's bona fide mistakes. No doubt Nehru made mistakes. But then you say this was the end all and be all. And I'm sorry to say these were not even the worst examples of bad leadership during the war. You had General Niranjan Prasad and General Pathania who actively deserted their command and fled. Not just, they deserted their position. They took their armies and they just retreated. One of them fled to Bhutan. I'm not sure, I think it was General Prasad. But General Call was surveying the scene by helicopter. He saw line upon line of troops heading westwards into Bhutan. And as a result of this, as I said, Brigadier Hoshiar Singh, the highest-ranking Indian Army officer to be killed in action, he was shot dead by the Chinese, partly because General Prasad did not come to his aid. His troops were backing out at that point of time. So here's the thing. You can obviously argue that the Chinese won in Arunachal. They would have won anyway. But the fact that we did not put up as much of a fight as we should have, our troops fought with courage and nothing else, as time said, those who should have taken their troops into battle and inflicted more casualties on the Chinese backed out. As a result of all this, we lost 4,500 men, 6,000 prisoners of war, and we took pretty much no prisoners of war, which is a humiliation. And the Chinese officially claimed 700 dead, but we know it was much more than that. It was definitely in the four digits. Because while we did poorly in Arunachal, but we did quite well in Ladakh, which brings me back to Ladakh.
Right. So, and just to add a note to the listeners, the reason the Chinese are likely to suffer casualties is that they were in an attacking mode, where they were advancing towards Indian posts. So it's quite likely that they would have suffered high numbers of casualties. And also the reason why we took no prisoners is because there was no Indian counterattack of any significance which was executed to its completion.
Absolutely.
So, and counterattacks generally are scenarios where armies take a lot of prisoners in these cases. So let's move on to Ladakh. What happened in Ladakh and why was the scenario so different from Arunachal Pradesh?
The single biggest factor, you phrased the question perfectly, the single biggest difference was generalship. We had proper leadership in Ladakh. In particular, there are two names which every Indian should know. You had General Daulat Singh and you had General Bikram Singh. So Daulat Singh was this clean-shaven, bald gentleman, quite an arresting personality. General Bikram Singh was a crusty old Sikh of the old school military tradition. But these men provided first-rate leadership. These are the men who said, we're going to stand here, we're going to look at the natural features that are to our advantage, and we're going to defend them. And there were many little victories over here because men stayed and fought. When the leadership is good, it's not just about how many troops you have. It's not just about how many materials you have. It's also about how good those men are. It's also about how well they are led, how motivated they are, and can they hold their nerve when under fire. These are the little things that separate a good war effort from a great one. And there's no question that in Ladakh we had all these. The best example is the Battle of Rizangla, which has been called India's Thermopylae. You had 120 Ahir soldiers from the Gurgaon district near Delhi. They were defending a high position. Unfortunately, there was an intervening ridge, so artillery support could not reach them. The ridge blotted out. So the Chinese threw a battalion, probably more than a battalion, more like several thousand men, into the capture of Rizangla. La, of course, means pass in the language of the region.
And so where is Rizangla captured this located, pass, basically? Where is it located, Rizangla?
So Rizangla, again, within Ladakh, I'll give listeners a kind of idea. So if you're looking at eastern Ladakh, now over there, the topography of the region is such, you've got different regions like Kargil, you've got the Leh region. Rizangla over here lies southeast of Chushul, southeast of the Chushul Valley. So it's a pretty high area, talking about 15 or 16,000 feet. So in this mountain pass, if the Chinese had taken this, they could have headed into Chushul and they could have taken a very strong vantage point from where it would have been very hard to dislodge them, which is why it is important to defend this. But when you have 120 troops against several thousand, it seemed undefendable, especially without artillery support. So what happened here was you had 13th Kumau regiment, the C company in particular. Almost all the troops were from, Gurgaon earlier. They were from Rewari in Haryana and Alwar in Rajasthan. And they were led by Major Shaitan Singh. So they held this position. Now at 5,000 meters, even after you're acclimatized, fighting can be extremely hard. I've got to point out here, fighting in the Himalayas is not at all like sea level fighting. You lose your breath much more quickly. You're expected to punch the hell out of someone. You're expected to shoot someone. You're expected to move fast. Do all this across the course of a day. It can take a lot out of a man. These guys fought like tigers. And finally, when the dust cleared, even the Chinese admitted a minimum of 500 casualties. The more likely figure is in the four digits. 120 men took out 1,000 men. And the Chinese were so shaken by this that after this, they had to put an end to the war after that. They weren't quite so confident of themselves continuing the war.
Correct. So the Battle of Rezangla was a turning point in Ladakh because strong natural feature was selected for defense by the Indian Army. And they held it with well-motivated, well-trained troops under good leadership, though they were fighting with inferior equipment.
Yes, it is. And so here's the thing. The Chinese came in great numbers. We didn't have those numbers there. But you had good generals who said, we are going to take positions that are defendable, sensible positions. We are not going to just clear out because there's no one here. I mean, if you think about it, this part of Ladakh is even less populated than many parts of Arunachal Pradesh. It makes even less sense to defend these areas than it did to defend Tawang, for example. People live in Tawang. But Bikram Singh and Daulat Singh said, no, we are going to defend this area and we're going to show how to defend it. And very
right.
Unfortunately, both of them were killed in a helicopter crash the very next year, along with an air vice marshal, under somewhat suspicious circumstances. It deprived the army of an enormous amount of military experience. But as a consequence of this, the army realized that the Chinese were defeatable in the Himalayas, and this was very valuable 5 years later.
What were the effects of 1962 on the Indian army as well as the Indian polity? What happened 5 years later in 1967? Find out more by listening to the next episode of the Armchair Strategist podcast. That's it for this episode of the Armchair Strategist podcast. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and share.